How are we starting?
Just dive into it.
Like, do you want to ask a question? Like, do you want to say...
What one of us can hear that song and feel untied to the wilderness?
What's on your mind these days, David?
And that cry filling the woods from every side. Loves to howl.
Like, what's something you were just spontaneously thinking about that you could tell me?
I've been embroiled in having an internal dialogue about the what they call the Nature's Fakers controversy.
Oh, what's that?
The Nature's Fakers controversy is an early 20th century literary debate that kind of pitted science versus sentiment when it came to the growing like conservation movement and the creation of sort of naturalists. So it's kind of about the extent to which animals can be anthropomorphized, or how sentimental we can be about the natural world. There's an author named Ernest Thompson Seton, and he had written a book in like 1898 called Wild Animals That I've Known, which I came across because I found a copy in a bookstore that I was working in, and I stole it. And it's a collection of Seton's observations about nature. So he spent a lot of time just walking, just hanging out in nature, getting to know what he would describe as getting to know animals, getting to know their personalities. And him and another popular writer at the time named William J. Long, he had a book in 1902 called School of the Woods. It was the same sort of thing.
What was this stuff really far out? Were animals wearing little hats and going to parties?
They all had names.
What would be a name?
Well, Lobo was the name of his wolf hero that kept kind of returning, and his girlfriend.
He had a
girlfriend. It was a white wolf named Blanca. William J. Long would tell stories. He was convinced that animals could do self-surgery, for example. So he tells the story of a bird breaking its leg and him observing this bird making a mixture of clay and straw and using its beak to apply it to its broken leg and then standing in the sun and letting it set. So what happens is a scientist, naturalist, conservationist named John Burroughs publishes an article in the Atlantic Monthly called Real and Sham Natural History that takes on what he calls this fantastical approach of giving so much magic to nature, of giving animals the abilities to reason and to learn. And Burroughs is furious. He thought it was preposterous. He said things like, you know, the crows do not train their young. They have no fortresses or schools or colleges or examining boards or diplomas or medals of honor or hospitals or churches or telephones or postal deliveries or anything of the sort.
Well, wait a minute. I mean, like, I know crows don't have telephones or postal deliveries, but I think people do know now that crows do train their young. I mean, I think that's been established by science now, that crows learn and they teach their young and they teach other families.
Yeah. So I think in a certain way, one of the fascinating things about it is that Seton and Long and Jack London and the people that they are affiliated with, you know, actually could be seen as kind of forward thinking. But it also brings up another question that boggles me about this debate is it even a debate? You know, are maybe these views completely reconcilable? Was the debate even necessary? You know, can science and sympathy exist alongside each other? Or even, is it possible that the world can operate safely with more than one set of truths about something?
I guess it's also the old nature versus society divide, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that has been a very hard split, but I think more and more now we're coming to see that those things really intermingle.
And that Long and Seton are really arguing that nature is interesting and accessible and worthy of observation by people who aren't considered or who don't consider themselves to be scientists. Long actually had a funny quote to describe the difference between the kind of scientific approach and the sympathetic approach. And he said, you know, it's the difference between the woman who cherishes her old-fashioned flower garden and the professor who lectures on botany in a college classroom.
Right.
Yeah, it's like one of the things about the whole debate is it's all written on both sides of it in a really patronizing, really problematic tone. And the whole movement super over-romanticizes indigenous culture. It really, like, I mean, the Seton's kind of movement that he makes is called the Woodcraft Indians, and he names himself the chief.
You know what else he does? He also, he gave himself an animal name. He was a chief in the Woodcraft movement, but he was specifically Chief Black Wolf.
Really?
And the, yeah, and the way he got that name is really interesting. So I don't know if you know much about Seton.
I mean, I know a little bit about Seton, yeah, but I don't know the Black Wolf narrative.
Okay, well, so Seton, as you might know, he was kind of like a scrawny kid, and he had some major daddy issues. His dad didn't really support him in wanting to be a naturalist.
No, his dad was an asshole. And he kind of became a naturalist because he lived in Toronto, and he would leave his house because his dad was so terrible to him. He would go wandering in what he called the unexplored wilderness north of Dundas.
Right, yeah, that unexplored wilderness.
Yeah, and then actually, when he turned 18, his father gave him a bill that itemized every expense of Ernest Thompson Seton's life, starting with the hospital expense of his birth, all the way up until that day, and kicked him out of the house and said, like, you know, you have the 6 months interest free, and then and Seton actually did end up paying back his father for the entire cost of his upbringing with interest, but never spoke to him again.
Right. So Seton's this young man, and he wants to be a naturalist, and his biggest ambition is to write a book about birds. I think the birds of Canada, which even at that time is not the most economically viable interest to have. So any he has this, you know, this need to prove himself to his dad. So one of the first things he does is he goes to Winnipeg, where some of his relatives have started homesteading. And on his way there, on the train ride, he has this really pivotal moment where the train gets slowed down in a blizzard, and he looks out the window, and he sees this wolf that's surrounded by a bunch of dogs, and the dogs are attacking
the
wolf.
Like wild dogs?
Farm dogs, dogs.
Okay.
I don't know.
Some kind of dog. Okay.
I don't know. I cannot verify these dogs.
Yeah.
I mean, that's actually a thing with a lot of these Seton stories, is that a lot of them are not totally verifiable. I've also read that he made up a lot of these stories about his dad because he had kind of this, he was always a storyteller, and having his dad be a hard ass was kind of part of this
like
myth.
A better narrative.
Yeah, this myth that he made around himself. So anyway, like he's in this train, and he's watching these dogs attack the wolf, and then the train pulls away, and he just hears these yelps of the dogs being, I guess, beaten back by the wolf, and he really starts to identify with this wolf that's being attacked
right,
by
he's
dogs.
Being beaten back, yes.
He's being beaten by dogs, and he's above the dogs. So he starts to see himself as this wild creature who's misunderstood by society. And what he does is he goes, once he's in Winnipeg, he starts killing wolves.
Well, just like indiscriminately?
maybe a little indiscriminately, but at this point in time, of course, like, people are trying to have livestock, and wolves are a real problem for that. So there's a bounty on wolves and coyotes.
Okay, right.
So he's fulfilling a bounty, but there seems to be this kind of like personal mission in it. As he kills wolves, he starts feeling even stronger and stronger in himself. He starts identifying with them as he outwits them, and eventually he starts taking on this persona of Black Wolf and starts getting everyone to call him Black Wolf.
He demands to be called Black Wolf.
I don't know. He's like, hey, call me Black Wolf or else. But he starts signing his books Black Wolf. He has a little paw print logo. I mean, I know, laugh, right? Like, if you one day came to me and said, call me, like, Big Heron, I would laugh at you. But I would also kind of, if you had a great story around it, I would also kind of think that was beautiful. Like, it's kind of beautiful to imagine that you could transform yourself through story like that.
Well, yes, but I mean, and there is something beautiful and lovely about that, but it also makes me a little bit uncomfortable.
Right.
This, and again, it's such a masculine narrative. I have to kill something so hard that I become it, you know.
Right, or like, I love it, so I kill it, and then I have it.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's actually a good point. Some of the things that make me uncomfortable about my enthusiasm for people like Seton. And years ago, and I can't remember where I acquired this information or actually, you know, find any way to verify it, and it doesn't really matter, but I was told that Seton was involved with a book, maybe the Woodcraft Indian Handbook or something for the Scouts, that was the first thing to ever outsell the Bible in America, the first book. And that made me think, what is our obsession sort of with all of this magic? You know, that I find myself vigorously defending the so-called nature fakers, But the idea that the only thing that could outsell this central cultural narrative of a magical boy sent from heaven...
You're talking about Jesus.
I'm talking about Jesus. We seem to be obsessed with, and myself included, you know, with needing some sort of magical narrative. And it made me ask, what is so inadequate about the human experience that we need some kind of narrative of magic?
So how did the controversy end?
The whole thing ends about 6 years later, get this, when the president steps in and is like, okay, debate's over, everybody. Teddy Roosevelt.
He was a hunter.
He was a big hunter, and he really didn't like the idea that animals could have personalities.
It makes it harder to hunt them, I guess.
It certainly does. He says that the stories that are being told are a crime against children. And what, you know, what him and Burroughs were doing is really denying the existence of a narrative that does include magic. What's the problem if you're just kind of building a story that might be fictional out of based on observations that helps things feel a little bit more magic? What Seton was doing was going out and making careful observations and writing stories about it, and in that sense, it was based in fact.
Right. I mean, if we call magic fiction, then why does it matter if we make fiction out of
right.
things that are true?
Yeah, definitely.
The one possible reason it matters is if you want to start calling yourself Black Wolf, it sounds like you have to first kill a lot of wolves.
There's certainly something quite problematic about it, you know, that notion that we need to start destroying our environments in order to romanticize them.
We feel a certain disappointment. Even though strangely alluring. That cry filling the woods from every side. I want you to call me adventure black. Stories and fascinating lies. We feel a certain delicious childlike disappointment. Once mournful and menacing. Listen.